major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
I think in all these countries there is a great cultural renaissance now. It's not necessarily a production of new trends or of new ideas. It's just a return to a healthy literary atmosphere in which all trends are accepted.
I think what my book says is that sex is just immensely important for our culture, and immensely important in organizing society. But we need to understand is that we make it important, we construct it, and then we impose that back upon nature.
Changing political bodies this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Thomas Pavel about the collapse of Marxism-Leninism and recent political transition in Europe. Thomas Pavel is a professor of comparative literature at Princeton University. Following that, I'll talk with Thomas LeCour of the University of California at Berkeley. Tom LeCour's new book is Making Sex, published last month by Harvard University Press. According to Thomas Pavel, as the ideas of the Enlightenment failed to retain their global dominions, Marxism and Leninism appeared to be the only successful imperial theory available. But recent political transformations in Central and Eastern Europe call for a reevaluation of Marxist-Leninist theory. Here is Thomas Pavel.
The lack of freedom was the main problem in these countries for the population. Uh-huh. So the population did not have cultural freedom.
You couldn't go out and write graffiti on the walls without being arrested.
No. And it was very difficult to write a good play. It was very difficult to make a good movie. People managed to do them, but they always risked being censored. It was always possible that the good movie would be just released 10, 15 years later during the next wave of so-called liberalization. By the way, speaking of liberalization, people there want just freedom. They don't want liberalization.
What's the difference between the two?
Liberalization means that it will be gradual and done by the government. Freedom means that it will be all at once and done by the people.
Doesn't it make any difference that we now have a playwright who is running Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, it's one whose plays were censored, and he was not able to see them performed in Czechoslovakia. So cultural freedom was not there. Political freedom, obviously not, and economic freedom, the same. So it was easy, in a sense, to start slowly giving people some cultural freedom. And even there, the cultural freedom didn't reach literature always. It reached literature only selectively, because literature is a question of words, of ideas. But modern music was allowed to be performed or composed.
Because it had a deeper tradition somehow than what we call pop culture in the West?
I don't know why, but perhaps it's just because it is less related to words, so it has a less clear political message. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the censor communist officials, for the important people in the hierarchy, to listen to Beethoven or to listen to modern music, Schoenberg, Berg, doesn't make any difference. It's equally foreign to them, so they did not really care about modern. More modern types of music.
What about the evolution of these new freedoms? My sense, again, having heard you in this luncheon seminar, is that what we have seen recently certainly didn't happen overnight, although that is the appearance, that bingo, we have all of a sudden a lot of, quote, revolutions, unquote, going on in what used to be Eastern Europe. What about this?
Yeah, the question is, are they genuinely revolutions.
And you think not, I take it?
I don't think they are revolutions, because a revolution is usually a release of new ideas. Well, here we don't see necessarily new ideas. We see a group of countries which want to go back to normal, what everyone calls going back to a normal life, to a normal economy, to a normal culture.
Yeah, you said that you listen to Radio Moscow and you hear people talking about wanting to get back to the, quote, normal.
To the normal.
The normal means what? Everything before 1917?
Not necessarily before 1917, maybe
1945.
Something normal, I think, means for them something closer to what they see in more developed countries. Mm-hmm. Something closer to what they see in the United States or in Western Europe.
And no, this isn't revolutionary?
This is perhaps evolutionary rather than revolutionary, because this, if it's a revolution, it is a revolution of imitation.
So we have to go back to what, 1789 and the French Revolution before we come to a real revolution?
I don't know if we have to go so far. There have been revolutions all over Europe in 1848, for instance. But it's not just a question of comparing with other revolutions. Let's think also about the decomposition of a major empire. Uh-huh. What if we
see... The Russian.
In our case, the Russian Empire, right. Certainly. What if what we see here is just like the chain of national movements in the British Empire toward after the end of the Second World War, happening when all these former colonies and dominions, mm-hmm, sense that Britain is not prepared to impose its rule anymore.
So is this what's giving rise to much of the ethnic unrest in Central Europe now?
It's very possible, because suddenly these countries sense that the rule imposed from Moscow is weaker, so they can detach themselves from this great empire. Is this a revolution? I don't know. A revolution, perhaps in the classic sense, mm-hmm, just violent change of regime. Okay. I would like to say what was so surprising and wonderful in Romania after the events in December is the fact that the Romanian culture didn't disappear.
It never had, really.
No, because of the dictatorship, not at all. As soon as there was some freedom of the press, people started writing very nicely and at a very high level. I saw some of the new literary and political publications. They have a superb level, extremely moderate, extremely well argued. So the culture is there. People just are waiting to express. People are very happy to have the possibility to express their thoughts, but these thoughts, they had them all along.
What about education, Thomas Pavel? What's going on in the universities in Central and Eastern Europe? How does the political turmoil affect education there?
Right. I would like to say first that even during the dictatorships, even during the last 40 years, the level of the education was quite high, mm-hmm, and the level of literacy of the population is quite high, most people virtually the entire population finishes high school, for instance. And although they are taught lots of ideology in which no one believes, obviously, the technical, mathematical, scientific education is pretty good. The university also had a pretty good level because they wanted to prevent students from being politically active.
So what you're saying is that these kids were not buying all this Marxism and Leninism through the whole thing.
No one ever believed in these things. And frankly, it's a bit ridiculous to talk about it. But when I was in Romania, the word Marx was used as an obscene word. And when we said Marx, everyone laughed. It is a joke.
American intellectuals, mm-hmm, Thomas Pavel, are talking, mm-hmm, about the end of history. We're talking about the scroll is about to unravel itself for the final time. What do you think about that?
Frankly, I never believed that history with a capital H ever existed. So how can you think of an end of something which never never existed? We always lived, and we always lived in history with
the historical present.
Right, in history with conflicts, with problems, nations, actors.
So these are academic games.
Right. This is a way of saying Hegel's idea of history is now dead. Mm-hmm. True, because it was never anything else than the speculation of a wonderfully heated mind.
Well, if there is no such thing as history, and
with a capital H, there is history. There are wars. There are problems. We have problems.
The way people live. If there is no history with a capital H, and if we have not in fact seen revolutions lately, recently in Central Europe, what are the ideas that are going to provide us with the models, the vocabulary for the continuation of European culture?
Oh, I think that the classical liberalism is the best possible framework, because it is a framework of freedom of speech and freedom of political conflict without violence, or with a minimum amount of violence. It is not, as some people say, a system which will make us happy forever, because we won't ever be happy. We'll be always miserable and full of conflicts. Obviously.
No? You believe in living in a fallen world, don't
right,
you?
Right. In a fallen, and we can laugh, we can smile, we can be now and then happy, but we don't need any kind of model which promises us happiness forever. We had Marx promised us this,
and it didn't work. What about religion? Is that going to be a force in these cultural and political changes in Europe?
This I'm not sure. At least for a while, I see that people who lost their interest in ideology seem to need some religious input. I see this happening. But what I also see is the reemergence of cultural patterns, perhaps shaped by religions of the past in that part of Europe.
Yeah, well, as I read in one of the book reviews the other day, the only thing that's universal is local politics.
Yes, right.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's right.
What about the difference that all of these events in Central and Eastern Europe, what difference are they going to make to the American so-called intellectual left? What's the relationship?
If I can judge America by what happened in France in the last 10 years, I would say that a reconstruction of the left is inevitable.
Not deconstruction.
No, not deconstruction. No, precisely not. What we need is a reconstruction of the left along more humanist and less socialist lines. We need to do here what has been done in France in the 70s, namely a return of the left to its own past, to its own ideals. Classical liberalism was a doctrine of the left. So why should it be monopolized by the right? So what we might see is a recentering. Uh-huh. Everyone will move towards the center, both left and right.
So history is not dead.
No, definitely not. But it is recentering itself.
Thomas Pavel is a professor of comparative literature at Princeton University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Changing Political Bodies continues. My guest now is Thomas LaCour of the University of California at Berkeley. Tom LaCour's new book is Making Sex, published last month by Harvard University Press. Making Sex is an account of the history of reproductive anatomy and physiology. Reversing Freud's famous statement, Tom LaCour argues that destiny is anatomy. Sex, in other words, is an artifice with social and political as well as biological implications. Here is Tom LaCour.
Making sex. Well, the argument of the book is that we all know that they're bodies, and that bodies have certain characteristics, and some we designate male and some we designate female. But we say a whole lot more about bodies than just that. We say that they're opposite sexes.
All right.
Or we say that they're complementary sexes. Or we say, some people might say that they're neighboring sexes. And
we're uncomfortable talking.
We're all, so my interest in this is really, what have we made of the body. So we find bodies out there in nature, and then we make something of them. One thing that might follow from that, historically, is that women are lesser versions of men. There's really one kind of human, which is the male.
So we start with one sex.
We start with one sex, and that's how I think the Greeks, by and large, thought of it. And that's how it was thought of more or less till the 18th century. There's one sex, and men are a better version of it, a more perfect, and women are a lesser version of
it. Well, now, wait a minute. Let me stop you. I mean, the Greeks are the Greeks, and we respect them, and it's all that stuff about Western civilization and the great books and everything. But aren't we? Don't we reinvent the wheel every time we move through some sort of a scientific revolution? And my goodness, we have Freud between us and the Greeks.
Sure. But the interesting thing about that was the hypothesis I started with. Well, look, we know a lot more about sex, and they had these bizarre views that were just wrong. In other words, the Greeks thought, and so did Renaissance doctors, that menstruation isn't a particular feminine function. It's a form of bleeding.
Had nothing to do with femininity.
Well, women did it by and large more than men did it because women were, in their view, cooler and were less likely to burn up a surplus of food.
No, wait. It had something to do with gender, but not anything to do with sexuality the other way around?
It had nothing to do with intrinsic biological difference. It's just women we know are a lesser version of men.
Yeah.
They understood lesser in terms of warmth and coldness.
Mm-hmm.
Though, again, they flipped that around sometimes. Whatever was better was male. Some people thought that males were cooler and then that was better.
This is all that stuff about the humors.
The humors and the hot and the cold. But the interesting thing about this is now, so back to your question about the scientific base of this, well, we now know that menstruation is controlled by hormones, which have a certain relation to the female body, and it has to do with the lining of the uterus, and we have a whole account. So you would say, come on, Lacour, sex isn't made. We know about the biology of this. It's just not true.
But this is all very recent.
That's all very recent. Now, exactly. But if you say, okay, that's fairly subtle. The obvious fact that women have babies and men don't was known to the Greeks. That didn't take any enormous discovery.
What about the psychological dimensions in the sense of nurturing and who's a better mother, quote unquote? And is it possible for a father to be a mother?
What I was going to say about this, you see, those are all sort of conditions of gender. And we know, and they knew in antiquity, and people have known that those are culturally different, that fathers act differently in some parts of the world than others. My interest in this was saying, okay, let's just talk about actual sex. How do people understand sex? The body, right? Now, as I said, some people, it was one way of understanding is that there are ordered along an axis in which the top of the axis is male.
Hierarchy
and the bottom is female. Another way to order it would be to say that no, they're like apples and oranges. There's no hierarchy related to apples and oranges.
Utterly different.
Utterly different. And you can say they're complementary. It's good to have a glass of orange juice in the morning. It's good to have an apple during the day.
Right.
So it's a complementary relationship between the sexes.
All right. Now, let's get back to one of the important formulations that I guess you historians are interested in, and that is to say, coming back to this point about a single sex, was it the Greeks, Aristotle, who said that it's one sex and we're all searching for that other perfect complementary half that is out there somewhere?
No, that was Plato.
That was Plato.
That was Plato in the Symposium. And he thought that's right, that there was once a kind of glob creature which was which had both male and female organs. And that this creature at one point angered the gods. And the gods cleaved the creature in half.
But that's all myth. That really has nothing to do with the kind of medical history that you're looking
at. Well, it only has to do with the medical history that I'm dealing with, in that if you believe that there is one sex, and you have to then give an account in the medical version of why there's heterosexuality.
Uh-huh.
The Greek account that you spoke of is given in the context of the Symposium, which is talking about love.
Uh-huh.
And they're trying to understand, well, why do men love each other?
Right.
And one of the accounts of why men love each other is because they seek themselves. But that's a version, you see, in general, in antiquity, and really till quite recently, the dominant view is that like loves like.
Well, then why is
it
that
men would love each other?
Why is it that homosexuality, for instance, is looked upon as a deviation? I mean, it sounds acceptable, natural for you to talk the way you've just been talking about a man loving another man, and yet all of a sudden, whoa, that's not right.
That's why the issue. Why I'm interested in the issue of making sex. Somehow, the system, any social system, has to, at some point, ensure that a certain percentage of its members engage in reproductive intercourse in order to reproduce themselves. Right, itself. How you do that varies enormously. And one way we do it is say, look, there are opposite sexes, opposites attract, and that's part of the order of the world. And to go away from that is unnatural.
All right, but underline that word "or" that you've just used now, Tom LeCur, is the word politics. You're talking about a political struggle. You're not talking about biology. You're talking about human power.
You're absolutely right. But the issue you see is that biology is out there, and we're always discovering more of it.
Are we trying to get around it?
Well, no. It's an interesting question. We're trying to get around it. I think what we're trying to do is stand on it, and it keeps someone else knocks it out and puts some other biology there. And the point is this: we all think that. Well, at least recently we think that we need to base social arrangements on biology. Huh. So people want to make a claim that, look...
Sociobiology is the term for
Well, it's
this,
partly
right?
sociobiology, but there are lots of examples of this. For example, in athletics, we want to say that there's male athletics and female athletics. Well, how do we tell the sexes apart?
Yeah, or in the military.
Well, in the military. But you know, as you know, there was a big controversy in the last Olympics in which some person who... by all appearances as a woman, and who won a medal, was disqualified because it turned out that in the cells of her cheek, she had the wrong chromosomes.
So she was, a definitional problem here.
Well, but my argument is that it's always a definitional problem. But so the two things that you're getting at, which are interesting, one is that we want to make social claims based on biology. And then we have to say, well, what biology is going to, in some sense, be the standard for the social claim.
So we have recourse to the medical doctors
we think we have recourse to the medical doctors. And one of my points is though that you can take any set of biological facts and more or less get quite different, in fact more or less contradictory cultural results. But the earlier view, and one that's still I think in some measure still around, is that the body really isn't foundational, that there really is a kind of metaphysical order. The world is sort of ordered by God, if you will. And we don't need biology to tell us that men are superior to women. That's what it is to be male. When God created Adam first, to give one account.
Now you're going to take a lot of heat for talking that way.
But that's an earlier account. And then once we believe that, then the body, the physical body, is simply a representation of that. So the Greeks would say, and people subsequently, based on other ideas of why men are superior, is why the male genital organs and the female genital organs are basically the same. Yeah. But men have their organs outside.
Inside out.
And women have them inside.
Right.
Now, that means essentially that the body represents a hierarchy that you already believe to exist prior to that. You see?
Yes, indeed.
So the issue then is not just as does a given set of biological facts prove something else, which is a modern debate, but the whole question of whether biology has to be a foundation at all. So that's why I say one sex is in some sense an oxymoron. It's a contradiction.
Right.
It doesn't make sense, but it does make sense if we don't believe in sex or the body as foundational. But in one way that's, I think, is sort of interesting that I've discovered in my work, that, for example, it was thought in the sexual revolution, a great deal was made of the discovery of female sexuality.
Uh-huh. You mean the fact that women could be passionate.
That women could be passionate. And then some people in the past believed that women were also passionate, but had been lost in the 19th century.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I've shown is that in some sense, basically all the things that Masters and Johnson said, except for the fiber optic pictures, were available in the 16th century, clearly. Right. And certainly for Freud.
Yeah.
And so the interesting thing is then what gets taken up in what context of that literature.
Uh-huh. Should we shoot the Puritans? Should we shoot all the Victorians? Are we looking here, are you looking, Tom LeCur, in this book on making sex, are you looking here for villains or are you looking for heroes?
I'm not looking for neither villains nor heroes, because what I really want to say is that there have always been these different accounts, and some people would argue that the Puritans were anti-sex, but there's an argument to be made.
And a lot of babies.
A lot of babies, and they were also for marital warmth. They associated warmth with warmth of the heart, and that warmth toward your spouse was an aspect of that. Mm-hmm. So I've always been leery of these arguments to say that our forefathers or foremothers were or were not interested in sex. We don't know the actual experiences in the body. Right. All I can tell you is that at any given time in history, at any given state of historical knowledge, people have understood the body as the sexual body in completely contradictory ways.
All right.
So that it's so that when I say that sex is contextual and mm-hmm. cultural, I don't want to deny the body. In fact, right. it's important to say that we have the bodies that differ, though they differ in lots of complicated, subtle ways. The question is, how do we take that difference?
Right.
Human males and human females are immensely close to each other in every relevant respect, and all the sort of tests that are done, the curves of anything but performance are close. So it's like daffodils and jonquils. We could say that those represent oppositions.
You don't believe in the war between the sexes?
Well, that certainly isn't the case. That's quite specific. But what's interesting is that a war, which may arise domestically, is construed as being between the sexes,
right.
and is then seen as a war between these two different kinds of bodies. I don't want to deny the whole history of men and women quarreling,
right.
but there's also the history of men and men quarreling, and women and women quarreling,
mm-hmm.
and parents and children quarreling. None of which could also be written biologically.
Doesn't have to be a sexual thing.
It doesn't have to be a sexual thing. We then, how to put it, the current way of talking about it is sort of writing it back onto the body. We then say mm-hmm. this is actually sexes warring rather than sets of individuals or all the other possible ways that we could construct the difference that divides the two warring sides.
Tom LaCour teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Tom LaCour's new book is Making Sex, published last month by Harvard University Press. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 527. That's program number 527. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Slang and American English. My guests will include Connie Ebley of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Alan Walker Reed of Columbia University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Early November 1922 brought news of the discovery of the tomb of King Tut at Luxor, Egypt. Scientists speculate that King Tut was 19 years old when he died, approximately 3,300 years ago. Early November 1979 saw the seizure of the American embassy in Iran. 52 hostages were finally released after 444 days in captivity. Early November birthdays include the entertainers Richard Burton and Will Rogers, the politicians Spiro Agnew and Eugene V. Debs, the historians Ida M. Tarbell and Will Durant, the preacher Billy Graham, the musicians Ignaz Paderewski and John Philip Sousa, the writers Oliver Goldsmith and Albert Camus, the inventor of basketball James Naismith, the painter William Hogarth, and the religious reformer Martin Luther. Finally, this week marks anniversaries for the Boston Fire of November 1872 and for the completion in early November of 1984 of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Changing Political Bodies, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Thomas Pavel of Princeton University will discuss the collapse of communism in Europe. Thomas LaCour of the University of California at Berkeley discusses changing notions of a different body politic, as set forth in his new book, Making Sex, Politics and Sexuality in Transition. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.